Doctor Story. Today I am talking to Victoria Marleigh about Lady Catherine Willoughby, Duchess of Suffolk. Hi Victoria, thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, thank you so much, Jessica. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here.
So today we're talking about Lady Catherine Willoughby, Duchess of Suffolk. But first, I thought we could talk a little bit about yourself. So you are of the filmmaking background, would you say that's correct?
Yes, that is correct. I've worked in the entertainment industry, mainly out of Los Angeles for the past 10 years, where I've kind of done everything, almost everything behind the scenes of film. I've worked in development at production companies, the people who kind of find the script, find the director, get the movie made. I've worked in casting, I've worked in post-production, I've been on set, which is usually my favorite thing to do. And then I'm also a screenwriter as well. So yes, I'm very much in La La Land out here trying to survive post-strike.
That's absolutely amazing. So, because you're not in a history field or the history career, how did you find Tudor history?
I think it's one of those things, even in the States, because obviously the voice gives it away, I'm not English. We still study the reign of King Henry VIII in the Tudor period in America, and it's funny because it's like it's also to me it feels also like asking an American, like, when did you first find out about like the Revolutionary War or George Washington? It feels like Henry, story of Henry and his wives in this period of time has always kind of been ubiquitous in our consciousness, even though it happened like 500 years ago. But I think I always say, I think it was media. I loved the movies that took place during this time. And then being, even though I don't have a degree in history, I have always loved it. And also as a storyteller, I'm a big believer that the truth is always stranger than fiction, or at least often stranger than fiction. So when I would watch a really cool historical drama that moved me, I was the nerd who would go researching to see what was real, what was fictionalized afterwards. And I think also kind of where we are right now in society and where I am in my life and career, I do find myself looking back to those who came before me for perseverance and hope. So I think that's part of why I've loved history ever since I was a little girl. And I think there's like a multiverse version of me somewhere who does have her like master's in history.
No, I think that's really nice, and I think it's really important. Well, I believe you don't need to have a history degree to love history. You can be an expert in a person or time in history, and you don't need to have your professor's cap on.
Thank you. Well, the best was when I studied abroad in the United Kingdom during university. I went to Grimthorpe Catherine. We're talking about Catherine Willoughby today. I went to her family home, and it was hilarious because all the, I showed up knowing everything about Catherine, so excited to engage and like walk on the same ground that she once walked on. And everyone at the castle at Grimthorpe was looking at me. They're like, are you reading history? Are you a student? I was like, nope, just a big fan. Love her. She's great. Go Catherine. Do you think she touched this wall? Like, wow, this is cool.
That's me with Anne Boleyn. So did she stand right here? Yeah.
Okay, wait. Let me just soak in the vibes.
So you talked about how you start to really get into history, but when did you first discover Catherine Willoughby?
It's so embarrassing, but it was through the Tudors, everyone's favorite smutty, sexy show. I had a huge crush on Henry Cavill, and again, as I said earlier, I was a huge nerd, and so I was watching the Tudors, and I was looking up all the different characters, and I remember reading about Charles Brandon, that because this was the first season of the Tudors before Catherine's character is on the show, and I remember reading about a much younger wife of Charles Brandon, who was super outspoken. And that's what initially drew me to her because I was a teenager when I started watching the Tudors. And I was like, wait, a cool teenage duchess who's like super witty and outspoken. She initially drew me in. And then as I did more and more research on her, I only fell more deeper in love with her life and who I believe she was, because she was a woman centuries ahead of her time in love, in how she lived her life and in her religion, in motherhood. And then I always say that I didn't know how much I needed her, actually, honestly, until 5-ish years, 6-ish years ago, when I suffered a major loss in my family, because she went through so much loss. And to me, she's such a model of resilience, as we'll get into it, because she loses a lot of people in her life, and especially in like a very concentrated period of time. Yet she like fought tooth and nail to rebuild, I think the life that she always wanted, and she got it. But it did not come easy. So I really adore and look up to her for that.
It's so nice when you find someone in history that you can really grip onto. And I think Catherine's story is so, can be so sad, but she's also, well, it's a bit rude to say, but she's a badass to me.
No, oh, I don't think that's rude at all.
She's
That might be the American talk, the crass American. I'm like, no, that's a huge compliment. She is such a badass.
So I think it's time to talk about the main lady today, Catherine. So, when was Catherine born and who were her parents?
Sure. She was born on March 22nd, either in 1519 or 1520, in Parham Old Hall, which was the Willoughby family home. Her father was William Willoughby, and her mother was Maria de Salinas. So Maria was Catherine of Aragon's closest friend. She actually came over, or Maria came over from Spain with Catherine of Aragon. And so it's no surprise that Maria named her daughter after her best friend and the queen. And King Henry really liked when kind of the Spanish ladies took after him and Catherine, when like an English guy would marry one of the Spanish ladies. So when, I mean, I there's obviously there's kind of scant research on this, but I do believe personally that Maria and William were a love match, and the king liked it, so he gave them a lot of land as a wedding present, and he named a ship after Maria.
I find that really interesting. I believe from what I've read that Maria and William were definitely a love match, because
Yeah.
I don't think from what I've read about Maria she would have settled for any less.
Slay. Yeah, I love it. I love my high standards queens. But I think too, and I think it also, and then we'll get into, Charles and the French Queen Mary Tudor. But I think to me, it's kind of really interesting that Catherine, this when she was young, was surrounded by and raised by two love matches, and I think that really informed how she lived her life when she grew up.
Where did Catherine spend her childhood mainly?
The first 6-ish years of her childhood, 6, 8-ish years of her childhood, was at Parham Old Hall, the Willoughby family home. And it was likely, sadly, like a lonely early childhood. Her father was doing his thing, and I think I not that Maria didn't love William, but I think Maria's true love was Catherine. And I'm not like trying to like queer bait anyone. I think it could have been queer, but probably was just like a really deep platonic love. Maria was so loyal to Catherine of Aragon, which meant, I think, she was little Catherine had a lot of time to herself with her nurse at Parham Old Hall when she was just un bebé.
Yeah, I think Maria and Catherine were real staunch friends, and I think because they both, I know Maria wasn't the only lady in waiting that came to England with Catherine, but I think these two women really bonded, and that's who her friend was at the end of the day. And I think you would protect your friend over anyone at the Tudor court.
Right. Especially like, I think we kind of forget, especially like all of us who love kind of, the Anne era of Tudor history, we forget like just all the pain, or not we forget, I shouldn't include anyone else in this. I sometimes forget like that terrible 7-year interlude between Arthur's death and Catherine marrying Henry. It's like poor Catherine of Aragon went through the ringer. So no wonder, like, it also kind of makes sense that Maria was very hands-on and very close with her friend who'd obviously gone through some major trauma in her life.
What happened for Catherine when her father died?
There's a term in screenwriting called the inciting incident, and it's kind of like the thing that happens that kind of sets the story on its course. And for me, when Catherine's father William dies, it's kind of the inciting incident in her life. So William, Catherine's father, dies in October 1526. And basically, she lost her stability and security. Her uncle, Christopher Willoughby, tried to take her inheritance from her, especially because Catherine was the only really surviving child of William and Maria. And obviously, she was a woman, so God forbid she had anything. So Christopher starts attacking Maria, especially because Catherine's inheritance was rather large. It was a lot of money. And then also, when her father died, to me, this is so in like it's so hard to understand, but this was very common practice back then, is that when her father died, she became a ward of the crown, which was standard at the time, that minors became royal wards and their wardship would be sold through the crown, even though her mother was like right there and alive and present in her life. Like, can you imagine if one of your parents dies and like even though you have your other parent, they're like, yep, you're a ward of the state now, and you're like, wait, what? But wait, but my mom's right here. So yeah, it was this huge kind of almost like seismic shift for Catherine.
So, because she becomes a ward of the state or the crown, does that mean she has to leave home and move to the new home of whoever becomes her ward keeper almost?
Yes, it does, or at least in Catherine's case, it does, because wardship was usually, especially a wardship of someone like Catherine, who had a lot of money, was sold to someone else of wealth and position for a high price, since they could actually make a lot of money from the administration of the ward's affairs. So it's not surprising that Catherine's very kind of lucrative wardship went to King Henry's best friend, Charles Brandon. And I do believe there's evidence to show that. I think Maria and Charles and Mary Tudor, they all knew each other, so it wasn't like she was going to a total stranger's house. But yeah, she left Parmold Hall for Westhorpe, where Charles lived. He was married to Mary Tudor at the time, who was King Henry's sister, known as the French Queen because of her very brief and a bit scandalous marriage to King Louis. We do have evidence that Brandon brought he bought Catherine's wardship in March 1529 for nearly £3,000, which was a lot of money, and she did indeed move into his household.
Do we know what Catherine did in that time? Was she a lady in waiting almost to the French queen, as we call her?
I think I imagine it was kind of exciting for little Catherine because she suddenly had two playmates. She had Frances and Eleanor Brandon, Charles's daughters, and then she was also originally betrothed to Charles's son, Henry, who was a few years younger than her. And I think from my research, I think Mary Tudor kind of, again, very much became a surrogate mother figure and was, I think she just kind of joined Frances and Eleanor in what would have been like the typical girl's education back then of running the home. Which, and this is also something that I find I have to explain a lot to the average American and people who aren't history nuts like us. Like, it wasn't like they were, she wasn't, when I say running the home, it's not like a house we'd live in now where it's like five, maybe 3 to 5 bedrooms, a couple thousand square feet. Like, these estates were the size of mid-sized companies. And also, they were land, like, we forget, like, this is where the term landlord comes from. They had tenants that they were responsible for. So, I think we can be very like kind of almost derivative and dismissive of when we describe women as running the home in the Tudor period. But that was no small feat, especially if they were of the aristocracy and had a lot of land to their name.
I always think it's quite hard to wrap your head around the fact, they were looking after a house, but the house was the size of 12 in one building.
Yeah, massive. I mean, again, and then like the nice thing is, thanks to the National Trust and historic royal palaces, we can go there and realize just what huge and complex operations these types of places were. It wasn't, again, it wasn't just like, oh, I have to vacuum the living room. There was a lot of moving parts and a lot of people to look after.
Absolutely. We know that Mary Tudor sadly dies in 1533. What changes happened for Catherine in this year?
Nothing much. No, I'm kidding. It's pretty uneventful. No, it was major again, like another huge kind of seismic shift for Catherine. So Mary Tudor, the French queen, dies in, as you said, in June 1533, and then 3 months later, our little Catherine, who's like 13 or 14, is married to Charles Brandon, who is in his late 40s, which for me is like insane. And like even back then, because back then it was not totally unheard of for women. Obviously life expectancy was a lot shorter. Girls got married super young, especially the aristocrats, all about like popping out those babies. But even Chapuis, the Spanish ambassador, mentioned Charles and Catherine's wedding in a letter in on September 31st, or September 30th, 1533, presumably because the age gap was so large. Like this was even anomalous for back then, where women were getting married super, super young. And part of that too, I mean, I this is where kind of I haven't done as much research, but I know on the surface it was about Catherine being able to keep her inheritance. And also Charles was not the most financially savvy of fellows. So I think he needed the money and she needed to be able to keep the money in it, because I think she was still getting a lot of grief from her uncle Christopher Willoughby. But then there's also, I think also in the past 10 or so years, there's been more and more evidence coming out that perhaps this was not totally above board, and that Charles maybe was, I mean, I guess we would call it sexually assaulting Catherine.
Yeah, I tried to research this in preparation for our chat, and there's so many conflicting statements about what happened and who was in charge. I mean, ultimately, he was the adult, and she was meant to marry his son.
It's nutso. And it's someone is I've been working on this mini series about Catherine, and to me it's so, like, I'm not saying it's cool or healthy, but to me it's so dramatically rich, because I think obviously Catherine likely thought of Charles Brandon as a father figure, and then almost overnight your father figure is now your husband. Your de facto siblings are now your stepchildren. It was just such a huge shift. And I also think, like, poor Henry, like, how would you feel if your dad married your fiance? Like, that's so, like, even as a little kid, like, that's so weird and bizarre. But I think, I guess anything, it's all like fair and love and war, and I guess holding on to your inheritance. So yeah, Catherine was a bride at the tender age of 13 or 14 in 1533.
Which is completely insane to think that a 13-year-old's getting married and becomes the head of the household for these children that she was in the schoolroom with 10 minutes ago.
And who are like, and Francis is older than her. Like, it's insane. Like, you're older than your stepchildren. Absolutely bizarre.
When she married Charles, did she stay at the family estate, or did she come to court and serve Anne Boleyn?
She did come to court. Her first appearance at court was likely Princess Elizabeth's christening in 1533. And I know she preferred mostly to be at home in the country. She was a country girl, but I think she obviously, just given who she was married to, she did go to court. She was involved in the with the queen, with Anne Boleyn. She was described as being witty, having a sharp tongue, and just devoted to learning. Again, even though she wasn't formally, she wasn't going to Cambridge like her male contemporaries at the time. She was very social. I mean, the word that always comes to mind to me when I imagine her is vibrant. And yeah, so she was involved, she was there in court. And then also, I think, God bless her, I can only imagine what it must have been like being so young, being at court, which, again, when I try to describe it to Americans, it's like if Hollywood and DC got mashed together. Like, can you imagine how cutthroat a place that is? Or like, you know, like Downing Street meets, I don't know, the London theater scene, like getting mashed together. It's like competitive, there's celebrity, but there's also politics. And I think I just can't imagine what it would be like being a young teenager. You've just gotten married. You know, your job is to pop out babies, and then you watch this woman get her head chopped off for not having a boy. So I personally, this is again me as a writer kind of making some inferences, but I think she just got right down to having kids. Like, and again, that might have been more of a Charles thing than a Catherine thing, but she did have two boys with Charles. The first was born in 1535. His name was Henry. Obviously, his namesake was the king, who was also his godfather. And then the second, her second child was named Charles after Charles Brandon, and he was born in 1537.
Do you think Anne Boleyn and many of the other people at the time before 1536 is where Catherine started to learn of the Lutheran views and opinions?
You think that Catherine converted sometime in the back half-ish of the 1530s, because by the late 1530s, the Scottish Protestant exile Alexander Seton was the Suffolk's private chaplain. And then when he died in 1542, they replaced him with John Pankhurst, who was also Protestant. So yes, I believe, you know, it was through coming to court and being exposed to all these new ideas in this time of upheaval with the split from Rome and Anne Boleyn, that she first got, and then her what will become her amazing friendship with Catherine Parr. She got this is where she first kind of got those ideas and was introduced to the Protestant religion.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the court was such a changing period, 1530s to 1540s. You don't know what religion it is to be safe, essentially.
Yeah, it's really nuts.
Because of Henry VIII, of why it's so changing, you know, he's Catholic at heart, and it's quite obvious he's still a Catholic.
I know that was a point where, like, I think Kat and I think ultimately where Catherine landed on the religious spectrum was she was definitely way more Protestant. Like, she wanted more than Henry's Protestantism. You can't see it because it's a podcast, but I'm doing air quotes.
Yes.
His Protestantism. But yeah, so yeah, she like, I don't want, I feel like this word can kind of have a bad connotation to it, but she was kind of radicalized, or her eyes were opened, because I think also she was out of like her, she was on out from under like her caretakers, her mother's or her nurse's thumb, and she was, again, she was so young, like you said, Jessica, she's trying to figure out who she is. And I think, you know, when she was introduced to these new ideas and she became friends with Catherine Parr, who was already quite a champion of the new religion, and I think she just soaked it all up, and it really resonated with her.
Would you say the 1540s is when Catherine really starts to come to court and be her own agent almost?
I think that's a beautiful way of putting it. And yeah, there's definitely evidence to support that. She was part of the Assembly of Ladies that met Anne of Cleves, when Anne of Cleves came to court and came to the UK in late 1539. Catherine was the highest ranking lady, as part of like the welcoming party, basically. And then we all know what happened to Anne of Cleves. So that wasn't a very long or fruitful marriage. Henry marries Catherine Howard. She, our Catherine Willoughby and Charles host Catherine Howard and the King at Grimsthorpe during their big famous royal progress in 1541. So she definitely, you know, I in my research it was described that she was kind of, you know, the first couple of years where Catherine was at court, she kind of kept to herself, which I think makes sense because she's still a teenager and a rather young teenager, and she's figuring everything out and getting the lay of the land. But like you said, Jessica, in the later 1530s and 1540s, she really, I think, comes into her own and starts becoming a power player in her own right.
Yeah, definitely what I think I gathered from my research. You know, she's growing up, and I think she's got her own opinions now, and she was not afraid to share her opinions either. I like how outspoken she is.
Yes, because I think also, again, this is like writer brain, but I love how I think it was her greatest gift, and also it got her, you know, as we'll discuss later, got her in a lot of hot water. But again, it's almost like that her religious beliefs. It was just something so essential and fundamental about her that she couldn't change. And I think, to me, and this was such a deadly, and I don't think that's being hyperbolic, such a deadly, dangerous kind of environment to live in. And the fact that she entered it so young and wasn't daunted by it, it was like, okay, I'm just going to tell everyone how I feel, and I'm like, and advocate for what I believe in, I think really speaks to her character. What an exceptional woman she was.
No, she truly was, and I think she's so overlooked in history, especially Tudor history, because she's there, she's right there, and she's not talked about.
I mean, not to be weird, but I'm like, this is my like destiny in life. I have to bring Catherine meaningfully to the screen because she's been portrayed a couple times, but like, she's always the she's a supporting character, which again, I totally get. But now I think that we have all these different representations of we've, feels like, and again, this is not a complaint. We have a different movie about like Anne or Henry coming out like every other year, which again, I obsess. Like, I love it. I think Catherine's story, you almost get the best of both worlds because you get a new, you get someone new, you get a new entry point, you get someone whose life was incredibly complex and fascinating and dramatic. Like, again, as I said, like super dramatically rich, but you still get to see the cast of characters you know and love because she was so close to all the action.
No, she truly was. I believe she should be in Firebrand, shouldn't she, in the upcoming film?
Yes.
She should be in that.
She should be, I think, I as again, as I am a history nerd and I'm a film nerd, and I was looking up the movie is a character who's called Kat, who looks like her, who seems to be that Alicia Vikander is Catherine Parr's friend. So I'm super, yeah, I'm so excited. It's so funny how I've just totally like internalized Catherine. I'm like, oh my God, my Catherine's gonna be in a movie. How exciting.
It's my child's on the screen.
No, like my baby history child is on the screen. Yeah, and I again, I think also like I love I especially I think it's so great because I think so much I'm really excited for Firebrand also and to see Catherine Willoughby and Catherine Parr's relationship on screen because I think it'll be a really interesting portrayal because I think we see and especially because most of these historic or these historical dramas are have been written and directed by men. And I think it's really easy to kind of fall into like the mean girl trope with how women at court were. And I'm not saying that these women weren't vicious and backstabbing Jane Rochford, but I think also we need to celebrate like the camaraderie of the women who, against all odds and kind of like the circumstances they were in, did cling to each other and make each other better. And I think Catherine Willoughby and Catherine Parr are shining examples of that.
They truly are. Because you've mentioned Catherine Parr, I think it's a brilliant time to start talking about when Catherine is queen and their
Yes.
friendship truly is shining right there.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about their friendship when Catherine was queen?
Yeah, sure. They were friends just to kind of set the stage. They were friends long before Catherine became queen. I think there was a they were very close friends. Parr, sometimes when I talk about this, I'll just use their last names because back in the Tudor period there were five names that everyone used. But Parr was 8 years older than Willoughby, and it was really their mutual concern and like investment in the new religion, and they both loved learning. That was, I think, what really brought them together. Also, Parr had also been widowed young and married to a man much older, so I think that was something that Willoughby really related to, and I like to imagine kind of looked to Catherine Parr to navigate. Like she was, I think in a lot of ways they were best friends, but she was, I think Parr was in my mind kind of almost, I could see her almost being like a big sister to Willoughby. And then when Henry married Catherine Parr in 1543, Willoughby was one of the 17 guests at their wedding. So I think it just shows that they were super, super close. This was not like a political, like getting social climb, getting into each other's good graces. They were truly, deeply, really, really good friends. And also they both shared, just if we're since we're talking about the new religion, I think in my mind, and again, I was telling Jessica before we started recording, sometimes there's things in my head because I've been working on the story of Catherine Willoughby for so long. I'm like, is this a historical fact or is this something I wrote when I was 20 and have deemed true? But I know that also, you know, they both were very close to Hugh Latimer, who was a major reformer back then. And Hugh really became Catherine Willoughby's kind of religious mentor. And I love Hugh Latimer too. I think he's so brilliant. And I think I can understand why Willoughby really connected with him, because Latimer was so open about the fact that he was like, I was the staunchest of Catholics and then I saw the light. And I think he really helped guide in a beautiful way, not in like a pressuring way, Willoughby's kind of religious conversion and her changes of heart around religion. And it's all tied in with Parr too, because I believe Catherine Parr was again like already kind of part of that world and perhaps maybe like helped introduce and acclimate her to the new religion.
Would you say that both Catherines, their religious beliefs started to get them into hot water in the mid 1540s?
I have no idea what you're talking about. No, I'm joking. Definitely. Yes. So basically, quickly, Charles dies in 1545. Catherine Willoughby is 25 years old. She technically becomes the Dowager Duchess, though the research I says they like still call her the Duchess of Suffolk. You know, and I think because of Charles not being in her life the way he used to be, you know, her position became less political, and Catherine Willoughby focused more on bringing the reformed religion to Lincolnshire, you know, the land she governed. And yes, so I think, and in my mind, this is where the whole rumor about Catherine Willoughby being the seventh queen comes from, because in 1546, the rumors start percolating that, Catherine Willoughby is going to become the seventh queen. You know, there's reports of Parr and King Henry not being on the best of terms. Personally, I think these were rumors that were fabricated by enemies of Catherine Parr to bring her down, since a lot of men at court didn't like how intelligent Parr was, how Protestant she was, and because she could kind of, for lack of a better term, work the king. I think they're like, no, 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 a smart woman, get her out. Like, nope, we can't do this. And I don't know. I to me, the evidence really doesn't point to Catherine ever being a mistress of the king. I think also, if you look at Catherine's life, look who she married after Charles. She married a commoner for love. And there's all these stories of her turning down a marriage proposal from the king of Poland. So I really think if she was power hungry, we would have been talking about Catherine, the Queen of Poland, not Catherine Willoughby, Duchess of Suffolk. You know, also something I love about Catherine is, and it was very iconoclastic for the time, is she refused some arranged marriages for her kids. She wanted them both like to find who they wanted. And so I think at the end of the day, Catherine was a romantic. So you know, she and Catherine Parr have a close friendship after the king dies. So I can't see, like, I don't know. I can't really, like, to me, it just doesn't compute that she was like screwing Henry behind her best friend's back. And also, not to be crude, but like, why throw away your closest friendship for Henry? Because he's like not, this is not like Jonathan Rhys-Meyers season one Tudor Henry of the Tudors Henry. This is like, this is the Henry, because I always, again, when I'm talking to Americans about Tudor history, I'm like, he was not always that Hans Holbein portrait that we all know him by. But at this point, he was. He was obese. He had the leg ulcer. And I don't know. Again, this is me being crude and inferring a lot. But like, why are you going to shack up with a guy like that, especially after being married to a much older man for over a decade? So this is my, thank you for coming to my TED Talk. This is my whole thing of like, I don't think she was a mistress. I think some people were trying to take down Catherine Parr, and their friendship was an easy target for them to try to turn. And then I think it also speaks to the Catherines to Parr and Willoughby, that they didn't let these rumors kind of shake the love that they had for each other.
No, I agree. I think it's a rumour that was spread to break that friendship up because of how close they were. I don't think Catherine Willoughby or Henry VIII would have actually gone anywhere near each other. I think he knew her from... I think, personally, how Henry VIII viewed Catherine Willoughby is his best mate's wife.
Exactly, exactly.
And even once Charles did sadly die in 1545, that was still his best mate's wife. In 1548, or I should be more specific, August 1548, we know Catherine Parr sadly passes away.
Yeah.
Do you have an opinion on whether Catherine Willoughby was the guardian of Mary, Catherine Parr's daughter?
Yes. So I'm rather certain, because there are record of letters that she wrote to her good friend William Cecil in the summer of 1549 about needing money to take care of Mary. So yes, just in case, just to, you know, again, set the stage for my sake as much as the listeners, you know, Henry dies, Catherine Parr can finally marry her love, Seymour, Baron Seymour. They welcome a child in 1548. They name her Mary. Tragically, Catherine Parr dies 8 days later, and not long after that, Seymour is sent to the Tower for treason. So this poor little baby is like almost, is essentially orphaned. 9 months later, in March 1549, on Mary's 7th month birthday, you know, her father's executed, and his dying wish is that Catherine brings up the baby. So, and just also for reference, at this time, Catherine's kids, her two sons, are 14 and 12. Arrangements were made that Mary would come live with Catherine at Grimsthorpe, and she would be giving a pension and furnishings for Mary's nursery, which actually failed to materialize. And I think everyone's like, but she's a duchess. Why is Catherine writing her friends like to get money to take care of this baby? And I think we have to remember, like, even though Catherine was well-to-do, Mary was technically of royal blood, and her expenses put a considerable burden on Catherine, and taking care of the infant was very financially draining to the duchess. And hence why she was, you know, there's actually, I think, record of at least two letters of her writing to William Cecil being like, I need you to help. Like, there, I hear there's money set aside to help take care of this baby. I need that money stat. And then sadly, I think, you know, Mary disappears completely from historical record by 1550. My estimated guess is the poor baby passed away, and she only lived a couple years, which sadly was pretty, you know, that wasn't unheard of at the time, but that's my whole take on it. I think she definitely was the guardian, did her best, and then sadly the baby passed away.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the general consensus, that she did look after Mary, and Mary sadly died a few years into infancy, which, as you say, wasn't uncommon. It was quite common child mortality in the Tudor period. In this time, sure. I'm trying to get the dates in my head. Catherine's two sons sadly die.
I know. It's just like this period for Catherine, it breaks my heart. Like, cause starting in 1545 to like 1550, she loses so many people. Like, her husband dies, her best friend dies, her best friend kids die, the monarch dies. And then I think the most devastating of the blows was Henry and Charles, her son, die in 1549. And like, or no, sorry, 1551.
No, I can't imagine what it must have been like. And as you say, the sweat and sickness, you'd be alive in the morning, you'd be dead by night. You know, it was vicious. It didn't matter high or low, you were dead.
Yeah.
A few years passed. So when Henry mm-hmm. VIII died, it mm-hmm. was his son, Edward VI, that became king. But sadly, Edward VI dies in 1553, and mm-hmm. his elder sister Mary comes to the throne. Obviously, I mean, I think it's quite conflicting, because obviously Mary I gets a lot of hate, and I think it's quite for me, it's quite conflicting because she was only doing what she thought was right. But obviously, for the people that were Protestant, it wasn't correct. And obviously, it seems really brutal. We know Catherine is able to flee abroad. Do we know anything of her time abroad?
Yes. Yeah. And yeah, I love what you said. I think it's important what you said right now, Jessica, because again, like I don't condone what Mary Tudor did, but I think you can understand it. This poor woman, like, can you imagine like watching your father do what he did to Catherine of Aragon, your mother? And I think obviously, and like sadly, therapy wasn't a thing back then. I think Mary Tudor really could have benefited from it. Like she had a really tough childhood and a really tough life. And again, like I can understand where she's coming from. I by no means excuse or condone it. And I think also it just kind of showed, like I know there's reports and evidence that she had a hysterical pregnancy. I think also it was really hard to be a woman back then, especially a woman of like aristocratic upbringing. And I know it was like, but they're rich, they were fine, but there was like this crazy pressure on them. So Catherine and Richard flee England, I believe on the, oh, so Richard, okay, this is, and again, it's like, I think it's funny, Catherine's story was the first screenplay I ever wrote. And it's just so funny to me because her life like lends itself to the story structure so beautifully. So perfect, like again, setting the stage, Richard leaves England first because he wants to like go get things set up for Catherine and baby Susan. He, you know, gets basically permission to leave the country from Gardner, saying he's collecting old debts of Charles, like to bring, you know, money for them to tax into the country. So, but it's like a tense interaction between Richard and Gardner, but Gardner allows it. And then on New Year's morning, Catherine escapes London with baby Susan and a small band of servants. They leave for the Low Countries. They were chased. Gardner had been watching Catherine since she arrived in London a few months before. But Catherine and her servants and the baby were able to make it to their barge at the pre-agreed upon rendezvous point in Lee, where I think Richard came back from the Low Countries to like meet her. But word had gotten out that the Duchess had fled, and it took like the little barge three times to make it past the British coastline. And I think, you know, Gardner's men boarded the ship. There's record that a crew member was questioned by Gardner's agents, but they weren't found out, thank God. Which again, to me is like, can you imagine, like you were running for your life and like you have like just the tension of like you can't get off the coastline of England, like you can't cross the channel because of bad weather. But they were able to escape to the Low Countries. They settled about 100 miles inland from the small town of Santon near Wesel. You know, they were living in disguise. They lived super simply. They took all precautions. Even so, their cover was compromised, and they left when they found out that like people were on to them. And again, because Gardner was pursuing them even from England, they fled within the day to Wesel. On top of everything, Catherine's pregnant again at 36, which is insane, especially like back then. So they live in Wesel for a little while. Catherine has her son Peregrine in Wesel on October 12th. 1555. And then in the winter of 1555 to 1556, Catherine and Richard learn again that there's ministers of Queen Mary coming for them. So first they flee to an area in Germany called High Dutchland. They settled in the mountains with Otto Heinrich, who was the Prince Palatine. They lived there for about a year, but their money was running low to the point where like Catherine's selling her jewelry so they can survive. Ultimately, they get in touch with King Sigismund of Poland, who is the same king who supposedly proposed marriage to Catherine. So if that was true and she turned him down, apparently King Sigismund is a good dude and a good sport because he offers Richard and Catherine asylum in Poland. So they would be safe there, but it was a very treacherous journey. They had to go through mountains. And again, they don't have like four-wheel drive on their, they don't have cars, they don't have four-wheel drive. And Catherine has two, like she's just two little babies. You know, it's like even nowadays, traveling with little kids is like a nightmare. And they're running for their lives, with way less means than we have now. So they leave High Dutchland in 1557, not far into their journey. They're mistakenly attacked by the local militia because they think, you know, Richard's trying to get their papers and they think he's pulling a weapon. There's a, you know, even though Richard spoke all these languages, I don't think he spoke the local language. So he gets imprisoned in the nearby town. But thankfully, they knew someone in the area. Catherine goes and gets like the local earl to intercede on their behalf, which I love. We love the princess saving her prince. And then ultimately, they do make it to Poland in one piece. Sigismund receives the Birdies as honored guests, and they receive a house and lands in the county of Crown. And I'm going to apologize to any Polish people listening for the name I'm about to butcher. So they get lands in the county of Crown in Samogitia to maintain and rule in Sigismund's name. So basically, they get like a house and some lands to look after on behalf of the Polish king. And after a really tumultuous couple of years, they finally can exhale and kind of enjoy their young family and enjoy their, you know, the freedom to worship as they see fit.
It's just utterly remarkable the life this woman has led to this point. You know, you think Charles Brandon dies, you know, it might she might quite not quite in down, but she'll go to the country, it'll be safe, she'll be fine, whatever.
Yeah, like hang out with her kids, like, you know.
But it's like boom, 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 you know. Mary
Absolutely.
dies in
Yeah.
November 1558, as does Gardner. I think it's the
Yes.
same day or something really close
Oh,
together.
that's mad.
Does Catherine come back to England or does she think, no, I'll stay in Poland?
She's like, you know what? I'm done with y'all. No, she does come back to England. They return to England in 1559, which is four years after they left. Yes, so it's once Elizabeth has succeeded to the throne, and they come back to England. Elizabeth restores their lands and possessions to them, and which is amazing. I'm sure Catherine is just so happy to be home. You know. In the 1540s, before they had to flee England, Catherine moved back to Grimsthorpe, which was like another Willoughby family home that had been greatly renovated. Yeah, I think what actually when they were receiving Catherine Howard and King Henry. So I think it's almost like she finally gets the thing that she's always wanted, is she's home in the countryside with the man she loves. And her two babies. And the nice thing, spoilers, but happy spoilers, like both Richard or no, Richard, her kids with Richard, Susan and Peregrine, you know, survive to adulthood and have their own interesting lives. And I remember when I went to Grimsthorpe back in 2012, the staff there told me that actually Peregrine, which means wanderer, which was a very apt thing for Catherine and Richard to name the baby they had in exile. Has become a family name. So yeah, so they get to come home. No, they don't have to look over their shoulder anymore either.
But it's just so nice to hear that, you know, it was kind of the struggle happens and she does finally have a bit of a happy ending. But does she stay at Grimsthorpe during the reign of Queen Elizabeth? You know, does she kind of stay away from court life?
No. Again, I think Catherine, this is why I relate to her, because like I can't relax like to save my life, and I feel like Catherine's like that too. You know, she always I think she always wanted like stimulation. So basically, she has Grimsthorpe in Lincolnshire, and then they do establish a house in London called Willoughby House in the Barbican in London. Sadly, Catherine, I think obviously Catherine went through so much on the continent. She's kind of plagued with minor illness for the rest of her life. Like she's never fully, I think, her like healthy, vital self again. Also, she's now in her 40s and 50s, which back then, you know, now it's like when you're in your 40s and 50s, it's like like, especially nowadays, it's like some people are in the best shape of their lives, but that was obviously not the reality in the 1500s. But yeah, Catherine, I think after she gets home and the dust settles, she then becomes very involved in the lives of her grandchildren, nieces, nephews, and her own children. So firstly, it's just like the rest of her life is like family drama. She tries to help her step-grandchild when she marries without the queen's consent in 1560. And then, you know, that happens like twice. And Catherine has to look after her step-grandchildren, like Catherine Grey and Lady Mary Grey, which again, Catherine's like, stop, like to the crowd, like stop foisting these children on me. But it's just, you know, I think obviously it was one thing when she didn't have the money to take care of Catherine Parr's little baby. But then also I think now in 1567, in 1560, when like the Grey children, the Grey girls are acting up, it's also, she's like, I'm not a young woman anymore. This is a lot to ask of me. Richard becomes a member of Parliament in 1563. Susan marries for the first time in 1570 to a man named Reginald Grey. Catherine campaigns to have him elevated to the peerage, campaigning to get him to be made the Earl of Kent. She tried to do the same thing for her husband, Richard, to give him a title, but ultimately he never gets to be Lord Willoughby. He's always just Richard Bertie. Sadly, Susan's first husband, Reginald, dies a year later. And then Susan remarries after Catherine dies to Sir John Wingfield, and they have like a nice conventional long marriage. Catherine's son Peregrine, Catherine sends him to stay with her close friend William Cecil, who's a top advisor to Queen Elizabeth. Catherine kind of knew what she was doing. I think obviously, like, she kind of knew how to, you know, she's been doing this since she was 13 years old. She's like lived in this world. So I think by the 1570s, she's quite the operator. And because of kind of Catherine's, you know, placing her kids in the right places, even though Elizabeth and Catherine were never that close, Queen Elizabeth would refer to Peregrine as my good Peregrine. And then he went on and made his name as a soldier and a man of action. And then there was like a lot of, again, like family drama. I think because Catherine was like, I want my kids to marry for love, she invites a bit of scandal into her life because Peregrine was engaged to Elizabeth Cavendish in 1572, but they never married. And then he, much to his mother's distress, was intent on marrying Mary de Vere. And both Catherine and the Queen didn't want Peregrine to marry her because of Mary's brother's abuse to his wife, Anne Cecil. But Peregrine was dead set on marrying Mary de Vere, and Catherine played a large hand in making sure that the marriage happened without, you know, the Queen really punishing the family for it. And then ultimately, Catherine dies quietly on September 19th, 1580. So she was about 60-ish, which was, you know, a bit, like, obviously she lived a very interesting long life, especially for that period.
No, I think she lived such a remarkable life, and you've told it so brilliantly.
Oh, you're so sweet, because I'm like not a historian. I'm like, I don't know what this is about.
No, you've told it so brilliantly, but before I let you go, I have to ask my five fun Tudor questions, as I call them.
Yay! Yes, let's do it.
First off, have you got a Tudor pet peeve?
Okay, this is very controversial. I might get kicked off this podcast for saying it, but I think something that, as someone who is a history nerd and also a screenwriter and a filmmaker, I get frustrated when people get angry when like a piece of Tudor media isn't perfectly accurate. I think when we're talking fiction or film adaptation, you have to change things. And I think, again, like, I get it as a history buff. I'll watch something like, that's not right. But no, this actually happened like this, and this happened like this. But I think, and I'm only saying this like as for my fellow history nerds to like exhale a little bit, or just kind of to explain where like a writer's coming from. When you're a historian telling these people's story, you are serving the facts, right? However, when you're a writer and you're adapting something or you're bringing something to life, especially on screen, your service, like, you have to serve a very specific story structure. One of my favorite quotes in a very popular screenwriting book called Save the Cat, written by Blake Snyder. Blake Snyder says that feature films, and I think it also applies for TV series too, are Swiss clocks of emotion. So when you're writing a movie about someone, even if, like with Catherine, like I've done all this research and I try to know everything I can and honor all the amazing things about her life, at the end of the day, my first priority is to make it as interesting and tense and dramatically rich of a story as possible, rather than like acknowledge all the little weird idiosyncrasies that happened.
No, I think that's actually quite an interesting Tudor pet peeve. I was expecting that, you know, someone says something inaccurate about Catherine Willoughby, so I was waiting for something.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if, like, again, if someone's like, she was the mistress of King Henry VIII, I would, like, snap to attention and, like, again, like, have my whole TED Talk at them. Not to them, but at them.
Secondly, and I think this is a brilliant question for you, have you got a favourite history film?
It's, oh my God, I could be like, we could do a whole hour plus podcast on this. Weirdly, this is, speaking of anachronisms, A Knight's Tale is so up there. I think that was one of the movies that really sparked my love for Renaissance history. I think also because A Knight's Tale does the anachronisms so well and so fun. Like, I love, because I think it's a really great way of, like, again, like giving a modern viewer the kind of language and context they need to understand medieval life, like with the 70s rock songs and like hot young Heath Ledger. But other favorites of mine, again, all over history. I mean, obviously Elizabeth with Cate Blanchett is up there. A recent inspiration, one of the most brilliant movies I've seen recently that was based on history was The Zone of Interest about the Commandant of Auschwitz, which, I mean, that film, I again, another hour long podcast, absolutely breathtaking, but in like a like in a really like jarring, almost horrifying way. I love The Favorite, Yorgos Lanthimos, The Favorite with Emma Stone and Olivia Colman and Rachel Weisz. I think, again, that's a story that feels stranger than fiction, but was mostly true. And then I love The Young Victoria because I love Emily Blunt. She's my queen. And also I also am quite, having my name is Victoria Elizabeth, so obviously I love anything about the queens named Victoria or Elizabeth. And then also some recent, I have another script about Gene Kelly and the making of Singing in the Rain, that got quite far in the Academy, like the Oscars Academy screenplay competition last year. And I feel like kind of two big references and historical films that kind of live in that world, or Maestro. I know a lot of people didn't like Maestro, but I loved Maestro with Bradley Cooper and Carey Mulligan, as well as Amadeus from the 80s, which is like, I think people sleep on how great that movie was about Mozart.
Some brilliant films you've named there. I think I need to go and watch the majority of these. So like, I just sleep on films.
Well, again, like, it's sad, like, not sadly, but like, when you're in, like, I'm just a nerd. I just eat, sleep, and breathe this stuff. And, Yeah, they're. I think all those films I listed do a really good job of conveying what actually happened and conveying the person that they're about, while also being beautifully made, really entertaining films. But yeah,
have you got a favorite history book?
Obviously, fiction is Wolf Hall. I'm sure that's the first time anyone has ever said this on this podcast. I think also Hilary Mantel is such a huge inspiration for me because she kind of is, I think, the first person so beautiful, one of the first people to so beautifully thread the needle of making things so accurate, but still so fascinating and rich and like such a beautiful story. And then my other favorite history book, nonfiction, if anyone wants to do more research about Catherine, is My Lady Suffolk by Evelyn Reed. It was published in the 60s. It's a hard one to get, but I was able, both when I was in the States and when I was in the UK, my local libraries, my school libraries had them. So I think that's a really interesting, it's one of the only really like comprehensive sources on Catherine's life. And I think also if you are like me and you're not a historian, Evelyn writes the book really beautifully, and it reads in like a novel in a way. Like it's not. I remember reading A World Lit Only by Fire in high school, and like it was like such, you know, it was such a dense nonfiction history book, and this one feels a little like more accessible for the average Joe or the average Jane.
I think that's really good, and I think I'm going to try and find a book on Catherine Willoughby because it's so hard to find a biography on her.
Truly. I'll send you the link to My Lady Suffolk.
Perfect. If you could witness any Tudor history event, where and when would you go?
Oh my God, this is such a difficult question, Jessica. I think honestly, I'm not that picky, but I just would want to like be at a party or a feast, anything with Anne Boleyn. Because I think obviously we have been talking about this woman for 500 years, and I want to see what all the hype is about. And I would pay such good money and maybe even give up like an organ, a non-essential organ, to just watch her interact with Henry.
Yes.
Because it's like, again, we've seen this portrayed so many different ways. And like, you know, it's almost like, I think especially for English actors, I feel like Anne and Henry have almost become like mythical. And, you know, it's like everyone wants to do their version of Hamlet or King Lear. And I actually think Henry is now becoming like one of those types of roles in media and modern media. Like most actors who are worth their salt, like tackle King Henry at some point in their career. Like, I mean, I love Damian Lewis's Henry in Wolf Hall, like chef's kiss. But yeah, I think, again, I'm not like, because I don't know if I'd want to meet Catherine, because I feel like it's like, don't meet your heroes. It's like, no, but Catherine, I had you down like this, like, how dare you actually be different? But I think I just want to see the relationship with my own eyes that we've been talking about for 500 years.
No, I think that's a really good one. I think they've kind of been, they're like a really sordid, weird version of Arthur and Guinevere almost.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, I'd love to see what she wrote back to him. I'd love to see the responses to them letters of her.
Yeah. Well, also, it's just like, their dynamic is so fascinating, because like, she, like, by all accounts, she kind of had him whipped.
Yeah.
So like, I'm, you know, like, and I think I think more than ever, I'm trying to make my way in the film industry. I have more and more respect for Anne, who was out here and play a man's game and got so far, but ultimately like couldn't, the game was rigged against her. So I think I would just, and also, you know, sadly, like there's, you know, because we live in a patriarchal society, there's so much about whether she was hot or not, or whether she was beautiful, or, you know, I just kind of, but I feel like, you know, there's certain people, even like, I think of certain actors I have like a crush on. I'm like, they're like, if you just looked at a picture of them, you're like, but then it's all about the energy. So I think I would just want to like get to feel Catherine's energy, or not Catherine, sorry, Anne's energy, like as it actually was.
Final question before I let you go. Have mm-hmm. you got a favorite history fact?
This is really difficult. And I know the second we sign off this call, I'll think of something else. But the thing I wrote down was, I really often think about, again, as a storyteller, just the irony of how Henry beheaded Anne Boleyn, basically because she couldn't give him a son. But then the woman who was supposedly the love of his life, Jane Seymour, dies giving him said son. And then on, like, to make the irony only more ironic, that son, like the you know, the much sought after legitimate son, Edward, dies young. And then the daughter of the most scandalous queen, Elizabeth, goes on to become one of the most magnificent monarchs in the past 100,000 years of English history. Like, it is so stranger than fiction. And like, I wish I could write something that epic. You know, it's just like, it's just so funny to me. Like, Henry did all this stuff. I think obviously he was, you know, no one thinks they're the villain of their own story, right? I think everyone thinks they're doing what they have to. And I just wonder what Henry would think, being like, actually, the kid that you like had with Anne Boleyn became the heir you'd always dreamt of. To me, that's just like amazing.
No, it truly is, and the irony is there.
It's there. And again, I think it also speaks to why, like, even now, we still return to this story because it is just so extraordinary.
No, I completely agree. Thank you so much for coming on today and talking about Catherine Brandon. It's been so wonderful to learn and hear your passion for her. It's been so
Thank
wonderful.
you.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. This was, again, no one has to pull my leg to talk about Catherine, and it's even more exciting, especially to talk to fellow history lovers about her. Because again, all my American friends are like, God, you and that weird Tudor Duchess. So, this was absolutely a delight.
If you enjoyed this episode and you loved all the others, please take the time to rate and review the show.